Morning, everyone. Can I start with a slight apology? Because it's just occurred to me, I've put on all these slides, taken all these slides from my updated NIV version of the Bible, and I've just noticed that there are some slight differences to the Church Bible. So, sorry about that, nothing major. Right. As you will appreciate, I'm inexperienced at being in this position at the front. So I hope you'll forgive me, but I'm going to begin with the application of this morning's passage. This is partly because, partly so that when you have someone speak to you later and ask you what was it about, you'll have no excuses for not knowing. But mostly it's because it's where our passage begins. Therefore, holy brothers and sisters who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, whom we acknowledge as our apostle and high priest. And we are being urged here to fix our thoughts on Jesus. And when you have that conversation about this morning, that's what I'd like you to recall. Fix your thoughts on Jesus. The remainder of this passage and the rest of what I'm going to say this morning is all about why this is a good idea. But the urging on you from the writer of this book of Hebrews and the application of what you will hear this morning is fix your thoughts on Jesus. When I was a teenager, I listened a bit to a guy called Major Ian Thomas, who founded an organisation called Torchbearers and taught at their Bible school in Capenray Hall up in the Lake District, which some of you may have heard of or have even been to. And one of the things he used to repeat when talking about studying the Bible, which lodged in my brain, was, wherefore the therefore? Or, what's the therefore, therefore? And you can understand why it lodged in my brain. I was reminded of this when looking at the beginning of this passage, because our passage begins with a therefore. And this therefore is turning our minds back to what's preceded where we arrive at in the Bible today. It turns our minds back to what Graham spoke about last week and David before him. And it gives us the first reason for fixing our thoughts on Jesus. And just to recap what has preceded this, we learn that Jesus is made higher than the angels. We learn that Jesus is the one who is crowned with glory and honor. We learn that Jesus has became fully human so that he might become our merciful and faithful high priest. And we learn that Jesus makes atonement for the sins of the people. So, the writer says, therefore, because of all these reasons, fix your thoughts on Jesus. The passage, in fact, is even more explicit about why the therefore is here, because it says, therefore, holy brothers and sisters, partakers of the heavenly calling, which takes us directly back to what we heard last week and to what we can read in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 11. Both the one who makes people holy and those who are made holy are the same family. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters. We are being reminded of the amazing thing that Jesus has done, that he has made us holy brothers and sisters. The writer is talking to us, and he's calling us holy. He refers to us as brothers and sisters. If you are a Christian, you are saved by the sacrifice of Jesus becoming fully human, suffering and dying for your sin, and breaking the power of death. And now, you, resident of suburban Reading in quiet Berkshire, now you are a holy brother or sister of Jesus, the Son of God. You are a partaker of heaven. Doesn't that cause your spirit to stir? Our writer is saying, fix your thoughts on this Jesus who has made you holy. Fix your thoughts on this Jesus who has made you a brother or sister of God. You may be thinking, well, I know what I'm like, and I know I'm not holy. Rachel may be thinking, I know what you're like. But Christian, the passage urges you to take your thoughts off yourself. Take your thoughts off your performance. Stop looking at your own weakness, your own disappointment and struggles and failings. And stop and fix your thoughts on Jesus, who makes us holy and members of the same family. This isn't a denial and this isn't wishful thinking, but this is faith. In Jesus, we will find all the holiness and heavenliness we need. And when we fix our thoughts on this Jesus, our relationship with the world around us changes. We find ourselves being drawn deeper into his holiness as he becomes our treasure. And as it says elsewhere in the Bible, where our treasure is, that's where our heart is also. But this exhortation to us to fix our thoughts on Jesus, it doesn't just look backwards at what we've already seen and heard in the letter. It looks forwards too. And the rest of the passage is full of further reasons why we should be giving our attention to the remarkable Jesus. As the subheading in the Church Bible suggests, the thrust of this passage now is to fix your thoughts on Jesus because he's even greater than Moses. Now, to understand the significance of this, we need to remember the context in which this letter was written. We've heard already from Graham and from David that this is a letter which is written to Jewish believers. They were suffering persecution from all sides, and they were experiencing the temptation to turn back to their old family and community and to traditional Jewish practices instead of following Jesus. In a commentary that I read when preparing for today, it says this. It says, to speak of Moses to the Jews was always a very difficult and delicate matter. It is hardly possible for Gentiles to understand or realize the veneration and affection with which the Jews regard Moses, the man of God. All their religious life, all their thoughts about God, all their practices and observances, all their hopes of the future, everything connected with God is with them also connected with Moses. Moses was the great apostle to them, the man sent unto them of God, the mediator of the old covenant. So having read of the almost impossibility of talking to Jews as a Gentile about Moses, I first of all thought of Tom and Esme and I gulped. But perhaps I think the context for this and the veneration with which the Jews had or have for Moses is best summed up by John chapter 9, the account we read in John chapter 9. In this chapter, Jesus heals a man who's been born blind by putting mud and saliva on the man's eyes. The Pharisees then set about investigating what's happened, and they were doing little to withhold the fact from those they were investigating that they were looking to discredit Jesus. So they called the man's parents because the Pharisees didn't believe that the man had been blind and could now see. And it says in verse 22 that the men's parents were afraid of those Jewish leaders because they knew that the leaders had decided that anyone who acknowledged Jesus as a Messiah would be put out of the synagogue, which of course is the exact fate which the receivers of this letter had faced. So what the man's parents did was they fudged the issues by saying, yes, he was blind, yes, he can now see, but you'll have to ask him about how that happened, which of course the Pharisees did. They asked the man again what had happened to him. And we read from verse 36, what happened then? Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered, I've told you already and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Then they hurled insults at him and said, You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. And the passage goes on and it ends with the man being thrown out of the synagogue because he declared that Jesus must have been from God, exactly as the receivers of this letter have been thrown out and ostracized. But I hope you see from this passage the high stool in which Moses was held. The Pharisees said, we're disciples of Moses. And it's in this context that the writer sets about showing that this Jesus is greater than Moses. I think it's significant for us, first of all, though, to note that when he does so, the writer of the letter doesn't set out to prove Jesus' superiority by trying to reduce Moses' stature. And that immediately is a contrast to how the Pharisees reacted, isn't it? They were making the same comparison between Jesus and Moses, and dismissively they said, as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from, which only served to show their ignorance. We've got a general election coming up, and no doubt we will hear an awful lot of one side telling us how the other side have got it wrong, or can't be trusted. There are certainly things which could have been said here about Moses, who of course committed murder, who was not permitted to enter the promised land himself. But the writer of this letter always concentrates on the greatness of Jesus and not on the weakness of man. And that is a principle which I'm sure we could would be worth us remembering, especially when we're tempted to compare ourselves to others, as we so often are. Instead, our passage begins with a parallel between Jesus and Moses, saying in verse 2, he's talking about Jesus, was faithful to the one who appointed him, just as Moses was faithful in all God's house. Jesus, of course, was faithful to God from the moment he was born until the moment he was tortured and murdered on the cross. He was sent from heaven with a job to do, a mission, and Jesus was faithful to that mission from the beginning to the end. The earliest record of Jesus speaking is when, as a 12-year-old, his parents lost him and then returned to find him in the temple in Jerusalem, and where he told them, "Didn't you know I had to be about my father's business? Didn't you know I had to be doing the mission?" At the beginning of this passage we've just looked at in John, where Jesus healed the blind man, he said, "As long as it is day, I must do the works of him who sent me." When he was praying with his disciples the night before his death at the Last Supper, it's recorded in John that he prayed, "I've brought you glory on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do." And of course, most graphically, in the Garden of Gethsemane, where through sweat and tears, Jesus showed his faithfulness to the one who sent him, praying, "Not my will, but your will be done." Jesus was faithful in every respect to the one who had appointed him. The second half of this verse is a quote from Numbers chapter 12, verse 7, where God is speaking to Moses' brother and sister, Miriam and Aaron, and says, "Moses is faithful in all my house. With him I speak face to face, clearly, and not in riddles. He sees the form of God." In Deuteronomy, it talks about Moses saying, "Since then no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel." And when we look at the life of Moses and his experience, we can well understand why these things are said. Because Moses was also faithful. When God told him to do something, he did it. God told him to speak to Pharaoh and to tell him to let my people go, and Moses did it. God told him to throw his rod on the stone so the stone turns to water, and Moses did it. God told him to take the commandments down to the people of Israel. Moses did it. God told him to raise your staff, stretch your hand over the Red Sea to divide the water and allow the Israelites to pass. Moses did it. Moses, just like Jesus, was faithful. But there the parallel ends. Because when Moses did these things and was faithful in doing them, it tells us in verse 5 that Moses did them as a servant in God's house. But when Jesus was faithful, he did so as the son over God's house. Moses was a faithful servant. God told him to do things and he did them. But it wasn't Moses who turned the rock to water. It wasn't Moses who parted the Red Sea or performed the miracles in front of Pharaoh. It was God. It was God's power. Jesus, on the other hand, is more than a servant. He is the Son of God. He is seated at the right hand of God. He has all the power of heaven at his disposal. Here the parallel between Moses, the servant, and Jesus, the Son, ends, because Jesus has the power. The distinction is graphically shown, isn't it, in the transfiguration when Jesus was alive. And Jesus went to the mountain and spoke with Moses and Elijah. And Peter rashly said, "Let's put up tents for the three of you." And God spoke from heaven, didn't he? God said, "This is my son. Listen to him." Not the servants. "This is my son. Listen to him." Not only is Jesus greater than Moses, as a son is greater than a servant, but he's also greater than Moses, as a builder is greater than the house. Now, this is where this passage can get complicated, so please bear with me. The key to this part is to understand that the word house, not as an object, not as a building, but as a family or a group of people. And there's precedent for doing this, both in the Bible and in modern life. The Bible, for example, talks about the house of David or the house of Israel. David, when he was dying, prayed for his house to be right with God. And of course, there's that famous verse in Joshua, which adorns a wall in many a Christian home: "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." In all these examples, the word house means family or household. Similarly, in history lessons, we learnt about the House of Tudors. We did, if Michael Gove got his way. We learnt about how the Queen is from the House of Windsor. So, if we look at these verses, let's look at the verses seeing house as signifying a family or household. Jesus has been found worthy of greater honor than Moses, just as the builder of a house has greater honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but God is the builder of everything. The house which this writer is talking about is the family of God. Under the old covenant, this was his chosen people, the Israelites. And Moses was a part of the house of Israel. Moses was part of God's family under the old covenant. But he was only a part of the family. He served the family and he was faithful in that service. But he was not the founder of that family. That had happened generations before him when God made the covenant with Abraham. And Moses couldn't add to the family. Jesus, on the other hand, is the founder of God's family. He was there in the beginning when the world was first created. Jesus was there when the covenant was made with Abraham. It was Jesus who spoke to Abraham at the burning bush and said, I am, I am. Just as Jesus said later when he was a man on earth. And of course, it's Jesus' death and resurrection which now founds our family under the new covenant. It is Jesus who even now adds to God's family by taking humans who are dead in their sins and making them holy members of his family. As it says in Ephesians, it's by grace you have been saved, through faith. This is not from yourself, it's a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus. Jesus is the creator, the founder of the family, the person who adds to the family. And in that way, he is so much greater than Moses, who is only a part of the family. When we recognize that Jesus is the builder of the church, the builder of our family, we see that the growth of the church, the growth of the family of those, family of God, is not a result of our own efforts, is it? We are totally dependent on Jesus for any growth that happens in the family of God. We cannot look to any part of the family, to any member of the family, or to any initiative to bring growth. We have to look to Jesus. We are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus. So the writer of this letter is saying to the Hebrews, I know how great Moses was. I know how important he is to you. But Jesus is greater than the greatest prophet. Jesus is more than just a servant in the family. Jesus is the Son. Jesus is not just part of the family. He's the founder and creator of the family. Jesus, and not Moses, is the one who will build the family. In fact, he also goes on to say, this great prophet Moses, he himself, he was pointing you to Jesus. He was directing everything to Jesus. Verse 5, Moses was faithful as a servant in God's house, bearing witness to what would be spoken by God, to what would be spoken by God in the future. Moses was there to get people to Jesus. In John chapter 5, it records Jesus when on earth speaking to the Jewish leaders who were trying to kill him at that time. And Jesus says, but do not think I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hopes are set. If you had believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. Moses' place in history was to point towards Jesus, the greater prophet, the greater apostle. And so this message to the beleaguered Jewish believers in the book of Hebrews, this message to them is clear. Fix your thoughts on Jesus. Don't go back to Moses. Don't go back to the inferior. Don't go to the signpost, but go to where the signpost is pointing. Don't go to the servant. Go to the member of the family. Go to the son. Go to the founder. Don't settle for Moses. His whole life was speaking about Jesus. Fix your thoughts on this Jesus. And so the message is the same for us today. Don't look to the gods of our age. Look to Jesus. Don't fix your thoughts on celebrity. Fix your thoughts on Jesus. Don't look to your career. Look to Jesus. Don't look to money. Look to Jesus. Don't settle for the pleasures of this world, which are so inferior to the eternal riches which are offered in Jesus. Don't even fix your thoughts on the members of God's family or the church activities or church attendance, but fix your thoughts on Jesus. We come to verse 6, which says, Christ is faithful as the Son over God's house, and we are his house, if indeed we hold firmly to our confidence and the hope in which we glory. Jesus is building his house, his family, and the wonderful news is, that's us. Peter explains it like this in 1 Peter chapter 2. You also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Now, returning to the receivers of this letter, the Jews, the house of Israel, of which Moses was a part, is described by a guy called Christopher Wright as the place of inclusion, a place of belonging and protection for the individual. It was where an individual found the substance and experience of his status as a member of the covenant people of God. That is what the receivers of this letter have been kicked out of. And it's no wonder that these believers were tempted to return. We know a little of this ourselves. We are believers called out of this world, and we've lost our place of inclusion and belonging in the world around us. We feel that when we are in a situation and the conversation turns somewhere we don't want to be. We feel that when people defame the name of our Saviour. Maybe you know this more directly. Maybe you have been rejected by friends and family because of your faith in Jesus. What a blessing and what a comfort it is to us in all these situations to hear this message. We are his house. We are his family. That old covenant family, which was where people found their substance, where they found their status, that's so much stronger in this new family of God which we are being built in. A family which consists of people from all nations. A family where there is neither Jew nor Gentile. There is neither slave nor free, male nor female. But we are all one in Jesus. This is the family of God. And this is where you can have inclusion. This is where you have belonging and protection in the family of Jesus. Founded by Jesus. Built by Jesus, secured by Jesus, guaranteed by Jesus. So, let's hold firmly to our confidence and the hope in which we glory, and let's fix our thoughts on Jesus. So, what does it actually mean to fix our thoughts on Jesus? Well, in the Authorized Version of the Bible, it translates that phrase as consider Jesus. And I understand that the original word, which forms the basis of both, comes from the Latin root of the word for stars. And the implication is that we should consider Jesus in the way that a stargazer or the captain of a ship in the days before GPS would consider the stars. We are to consume them. We are to study them. We are to seek to know everything about them and to look to them for guidance and direction. This is the way that that captain or that stargazer would regard stars, but this is the way that we should regard Jesus. This is the way we should fix our thoughts on Jesus. As A.W. Pink says, to consider Christ means to behold him, not simply by a passing glance or giving him an occasional thought, but by the heart being fully occupied with him. And from all we've seen today, is he not worth that? Doesn't this Jesus, who though he was God, became man, who builds the family of God, who made us holy, who created all things, who is greater than the greatest prophet, who all history points towards, doesn't this Jesus demand from us more than a passing glance or an occasional thought? Doesn't this Jesus demand from us that we consume him, that we study him, that our heart is fully occupied with him? Jesus is greater than the greatest man in history. Let's fix our thoughts on him and let's study Jesus.